Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
It was a blast in the beginning, bro. The first couple of years are amazing. You're like, this girl is in the cover of a magazine. And this is my girlfriend. Like, other people are turning heads. And then a couple years into that, or 4 or 5 of those later, you're not having really interesting conversations and they don't really like you and you don't really like them. And you just realize you're signed up for the wrong value system. And in fact, if I think about the customers, right, who's spending the money, the guys buying $1,000 bottles of champagne, you know, many of these are middle-aged men who have divorced their wives to run off with 20-year-old girls who are often younger than their daughters, who won't speak to them because they hate the fact that dad divorced mom for some 23-year-old model. And some guy's got 4 buttons down and he's going to drop $7,000 on his American Express Black Card in champagne. But, you know, is that living? You know, is he creating a legacy?
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Scott, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, this should be fun. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So as I was saying before we hit record, it's kind of amazing that you have not been a guest before, seeing as the fact that probably thousands of people that I've interviewed are connected to you in one way or another. And chances are most people listening have heard of you unless they've been on the moon for the last 20 years. But having read your book, I got the sense that your parents have had a significant impact on your life. And I wanted to start by asking you, what did they do for a living? And what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of them that have influenced and shaped what you've ended up doing with your life and your career?
Well, I've had a really interesting childhood. My dad was a middle-class businessman, worked at an electrical engineering firm that sold transformers, like those big power supplies that you see on telephone poles. My mom was a writer. They had met at the University of Pennsylvania at Wharton. And when I was 4 years old, we moved from Philadelphia to the suburbs of New Jersey. My dad wanted to get closer to his work and reduce his commute so that he could spend more time with me and hope to have a big family. And unknown to us, we moved into this pretty drab gray house at the end of a cul-de-sac in the dead of winter. And the house that we had just purchased came with a carbon monoxide gas leak. And this was many years before the carbon monoxide detectors that we have now, you know, were invented. So we move in and we all start getting these symptoms. And on New Year's Day, 1980, my mom walks across the bedroom and she collapses unconscious to the floor. So she's the canary in the coal mine, which leads to the discovery of carbon monoxide in her bloodstream, massive amounts, and then the discovery of the actual gas leak down in the basement. So I never really knew my mom in her former self. She became an invalid from this point on, and I was 4. And her life really kind of ended as her health was taken away from her. What happened to her was her immune system irreparably shut down and was unable to process anything chemical, anything synthetic from this point on. So she wore masks for the next 50 years. She was connected to oxygen at various times. She lived avoiding exposure to anything chemical. I mean, the ink from a book, the print from a book would make her sick. A whiff of car fumes, you know, the streets over, or the whiff of fabric softener as somebody was doing laundry would just set her into spiraling symptoms. So she lived in isolation in special containment rooms covered in, you know, bathrooms washed down with special soap and on army cots that had been washed in baking soda. So that was kind of mom. Dad, and I'll get to what I learned, dad stuck by her. So he was unbelievably loyal. My parents had a really authentic Christian faith, and they decided not to sue the gas company. They didn't want to become bitter, and they just believed that, you know, God would provide for our family. So he was this guy who didn't sleep in the same room as his wife for a decade. And we both moved into caregiver roles. So we were doing the cooking for her, and we were doing the cleaning and the laundry, and really just helping to care for my mother. So what I learned from her was this unbelievable resilience. And throughout the adversity of the rest of her life, she had a joy and an optimism, and she tried to use her time writing letters to encourage other people. Because she couldn't see them in real life. And I learned, you know, a deep sense of integrity and loyalty from my father, who just stayed by her side until she eventually died in her 70s.
Yeah. You know, like, I wonder how your understanding of that experience evolves with age. Because if you're four when that starts to happen, I'd imagine in a lot of ways, that's kind of traumatizing. Not having a consistent maternal figure. And I wonder how that sort of understanding of the reality of the situation has kind of evolved with age.
I think the first time I really had to take stock of my childhood was when I was working on the book. And I was working with this amazing woman who was helping me with interviews. And her name was Lisa. And she interviewed my mom and interviewed some friends and interviewed my dad. And I remember after that, she just said, "I feel so sorry for you. You lost your childhood," you know, and she had this sense of deep trauma. My narrative was, I had a great childhood. And this is just all I knew. Mom was sick and we all did the best that we could. And we were optimistic, and this taught me resilience and independence. And yeah, later, you know, I could maybe credit some of the entrepreneurship back to those things that I was doing at a young age. So my look back on childhood was very different than her perception from the outside of it. And, you know, maybe the truth is somewhere in between. But, you know, I certainly didn't grow up feeling sorry for myself. I grew up just, that was all I knew. And I didn't see mom's face, and I helped to take care of my mom.
You know, I think that what is so fascinating is that somebody who didn't have the experience interpreted as incredibly traumatic, and you seem to have this overwhelmingly optimistic interpretation of it. Like, what do you think it is that differentiates the person who creates a narrative that you did versus the one that somebody who didn't even experience this did?
I think we were all optimistic. I mean, we made the best of what was a very bad situation for many, many years. And my family were fighters. They didn't want to give up. I mean, we kept looking for potential cures to this and, you know, ways to repair her immune system. And, you know, gosh, I thought of all the different treatments and doctors and clinics we saw over the years, you know, to not find any good answer or result. But there was just a sense of, this is what we keep doing. We don't give up, and we continue to fight for a better future. or for the hope of a better future.
Talk to me about the role that faith has played in your life, because I get the sense that there are moments when it didn't matter. We'll get to that. And there are moments when it was significant. It seems like early on it played a huge role, but then it kind of didn't. And then it eventually did again.
You know, early on, I think it was very much the faith of my parents. I was raised in the church and my parents were non-denominational. So we would go to different flavors of churches as we moved around a little bit, you know, eventually just trying to move to the country to get clean air for mom as a baseline. I remember liking it, playing piano on Sunday, you know, for the church service and being involved in the youth group. And I didn't have any negative kind of connotations of church, you know, growing up. I think it was really when I turned 18 that, you know, I had my unfortunately cliche prodigal son moment where I said, okay, now I want to have some real fun outside the rules of the church. And I do want to smoke and I do want to drink and I do want to swear and I do want to sleep around and I do want to chase money and cars and watches and status and celebrity. And that was that kind of confluence was it collided with me also moving to New York City, which I thought was the greatest city in the entire world, where you could do all of these things and pursue all these things in style. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think act one was, you know, a faithful kid. Act two was, I want to have fun. And in some ways, maybe, you know, I began to act like a child at 18 years old and maybe, you know, explore the childhood that I never had in New York City and just chasing fun endlessly. And this came through stumbling into this job as a nightclub promoter where I wound up working at 40 different nightclubs over the next 10 years, throwing parties. I mean, so my actual job, my profession over a decade was partying for a living and throwing parties. Yeah. You know, and in some ways, maybe the party I never had as a kid.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because my parents and I will have these conversations about religion and they become, you know, more religious as they've gotten older. Like all their friends are from, you know, the community, like our temple. And my big problem, especially with religion, when as it relates to Hinduism, if you've been to an Indian wedding, you know, this is it's too damn time consuming. Like it takes too long. Yeah. And this is like the argument that my dad and I are like, why does everything here take so long?
Well, I mean, Christianity, you can get in and out in 60 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Good luck doing that at an Indian wedding. Although apparently now you can hire the same priest who does your Hindu ceremony. He'll actually charge you more to do the condensed version.
Oh my gosh, that's funny. Yeah, that is very funny.
All our friends who are like, you know, like American, you know, born in the U.S. but married to other Indians, they're like, our friends are not going to sit through 3 hours of this. And I remember even at my sister's thing, like people were all sitting down expecting like the ceremony to start. Then, you know, they brought out a coffee cart and they finally realized like none of the Indian people here are sitting down. It's like, that's because we all know this is going to take forever.
Exactly. Exactly.
But
I wonder, maybe it's fair. I did come, you know, act three of my life. I did wind up coming back to faith, I think in a slightly different way as an adult, being able to opt in. But that's really after I had made an absolute giant mess of my life, pursuing girls and cars and watches and gambling and travel and just not finding what I was looking for. And, you know, I kind of found myself 10 years later in the proverbial pigsty, you know, and missing home, you know, missing the, I wouldn't say the comfort, but missing the foundation of morality and spirituality and virtue, you know, wholesomeness in a way.
Yeah.
As I was living such a destructive lifestyle.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah, that was, I think, the thing that struck me most is to go from, you know, sort of this religious upbringing to what effectively sounds like hedonism, because you say in the book, somewhere along the way, the sameness of nightlife, booze, drugs, girls, repeat made me restless. I wanted to change. And the more things stayed the same, the more booze, drugs, and girls I needed to force my mind and body to show up for work with a smile. So
I wrote that.
In a lot of,
that's not bad.
Yeah, it's not. Well, so like in a lot of ways, I think that, look, if I couldn't
say it that succinctly now, I'll tell you that.
Well, I'll tell you something. 20-year-old me would have been like, this sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Like, this sounds amazing. This is like the dream life that any 20-something would want to have. It's like booze, drugs, girls every night. Like, so talk to me about the reality of the situation versus the perception. Because I think from the outside looking in, it's like, wow, this is glamorous.
I think that's fair. And I think that's a really nice insight. Because, you know, young people do want to go hang out with Denzel Washington and supermodels, right? Like, what sounds better than that?
I kind of want to do that now, and I'm about to be 46 in 2 days.
I think. Well, part of it is no. I'm going to say it's the whole environment. You know what your job is actually like as a nightclub promoter is, it becomes very monotonous, and you know you're having in some ways. Okay, so dinner at 10 p.m. at night. And you have gotten some modeling agency booker to bring 6 to 8 models for a free dinner. And then you have filled that dinner with guys from finance who are going to pay for everything. who want to be around the models. Okay, so that looks really good, and you're at the nicest restaurant, and it's a $5,000 tab that, you know, you as the nightclub promoter or the host, you know, are just, you know, you're never paying for anything. But it's not a terribly interesting group of people. So as good as it looks as you walk into that restaurant and say, oh my gosh, here are these unbelievably beautiful young girls and these guys in suits, it's not very interesting conversation. All right, so that's 10 o'clock till, let's say, 12:30. Then you go to the club at 12:30, and the DJ that you've hired is playing the same songs over and over again every single night, you know, just like a radio disc jockey would. And I mean, how tired they must be of any top 40 song that they have to play over and over and over again, because that's what the people want. The volume in the cloud is incredibly loud, and your level of intellectual conversation, if there was any at the dinner, you know, drops remarkably, because now you're shouting and kind of spitting at people. And, you know, that goes till, I don't know, call it 3 o'clock. And then everybody wants to go to after hours and do cocaine. And, you know, on a night that started at 10, you might get home around 10:30, 11 the next day. And I just remember this one day, you know, it's noon and I'm still high and I'm taking Ambien to try to come down, and it's bright in this apartment. So I'm trying to stuff a comforter in the window to block out the light. And as I look out this window on Houston Street in New York City, then you see a bunch of people just on lunch break, you know, going about their healthy, you know, probably eating vegan, you know, and this is how your night ends at noon. And then, you know, you have to get up at 8 o'clock at night, make a bunch of calls, put the whole group together and do it again. So it really did get boring. I mean, maybe fun for the first few years, but boy, year five, year seven, it really felt like a job. And so many of the relationships are so shallow, because as nightclub promoters, you know, you almost have to date a model because that's just part of the job. Well, I mean, I was never really in love with the girls I was dating, and they weren't in love with me, you know, and it was cool for models to date nightclub promoters, because then they could go out and eat and drink for free and be seen with other beautiful people. So yeah. The whole thing is kind of really vapid and shallow, and ages more poorly over time. Yeah. And then you start, you know, overusing, you know, you start drinking even more and doing even more drugs to kind of numb out the, you know, as some sort of balm for the boredom, I guess. So I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, no, it is.
It was a blast in the beginning, bro. The first couple of years are amazing. You're like, this girl is in the cover of a magazine, and this is my girlfriend. You know, like other people are, you know, you walk down the street and turning heads, and then, you know, a couple of years into that, or, you know, four or five of those later, you know, it's you're not having really interesting conversations, and they don't really like you, and you don't really like them, and you just realize you've signed up for the wrong value system. And in fact, you know, if I think about the customers, right, who's spending the money, the guys buying $1,000 bottles of champagne, you know, many of these are middle-aged men who have divorced their wives to run off with 20-year-old girls who are often younger than their daughters, who won't speak to them because they hate the fact that dad divorced mom for some 23-year-old model. And, you know, so, you know, and some guy's got four buttons down and he's going to drop $7,000 on his American Express Black Card in champagne. But, you know, is that living? Is he creating a legacy?
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting here is that the glitz and glamour of all is really just a mirage. Like when we see it from the outside, that's kind of the sense I'm getting. Cause like, yeah, like if I'm a 20 something, like, you know, as I was reading this, I was like, man, I'm like, I wish my 20s were this interesting, you know? Yeah. But I also get that, you know, as I've gotten older, I'm like, okay, yeah, like this sounds hellish. So, you know, the other thing you say is, you know, every night I'd snort another line of cocaine and pass the rolled up bill to another pretty girl and think to myself, this is not who I am. This is not who I want to be. This is not how I thought my life would turn out. Like you said, it was a lot of fun. And so what is it that pushes somebody to the breaking point? And Also, the other thing I wonder about is I'd imagine, and you mentioned that conversations were not that interesting or vapid, but I'd also imagine this is like a laboratory for studying human behavior.
Yeah, but again, not the most interesting forms of human behavior.
Just people getting shit-faced and high?
Exactly. And slurring their words and, you know, sloppily making out. You know, or dancing. I mean, yeah. It's only, you know, 52 weeks a year, 3 parties a night, you know, 150 parties a year. I mean, it's not that interesting to watch people dance anymore.
Yeah. My thought was, this sounds like Groundhog Day with booze, drugs, and women.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
So what is it that pushes anybody and then finally pushed you to the breaking point where you're like, okay, this is, I'm done. I can't do this anymore.
Well, you know, I wrote about this in the book. There were some health issues and
yeah.
Maybe no surprise to anybody listening after describing a typical night. But, you know, my body went numb one day and I just remember walking over, turning on the tap, you know, watching the steam come from the hot water, sticking my arm under and I couldn't feel it. And just thinking, oh, wow, something is very wrong. Maybe I have a brain tumor. Maybe I have some sort of incurable disease. And I think that was such an important moment because I really had been living like I was immortal. You know, I'd been living like nothing could stop me and recklessly, and I was never going to overdose and almost running so fast, nothing would ever catch up. And then one day, what if something is wrong with me? What if I do have a brain tumor? What if I was given 4 weeks to live? What if my life ended here? What would I be known for? What would they write on my tombstone? How would I be remembered? I'd be remembered as some like degenerate scumbag cokehead nightclub promoter who got 1 million people drunk. And well, nobody would remember that. Nobody would care about that. It was a negative contribution to society. Mm-hmm. So that really began a taking stock period, a discovery of, you know, and even heaven and hell, you know, did I still believe in that kind of afterlife? And well, if I did, if that was possible, I didn't think I was going to heaven, bro. No. I mean, you don't let guys like me into heaven. Guys like me typically don't want to get into heaven. They want to hang out. You know? So that began a process that took, about 6 months and, you know, there was an incident I write about in Nightlife where I fired somebody and they threatened my life. And you know, I'd had my life threatened so many times in clubs because you don't let someone in and they're embarrassed and they say they're going to come and shoot you. But there was a really good kind of catalyzing event for me at the end of this thinking and discovery process and trying to find my way back to faith, trying to kind of rediscover what a moral life would look like. And you know, this makes even more sense to me now at 48 years old. I mean, I'm just a radical guy. So it's much easier for me to do what I did, which was sell everything I owned and go volunteer for a medical mission in the poorest country in the world. You know, that was easier than to make small changes in my life.
Yeah.
So that's what I did in the 6 months kind of after those health, and the health issues just subsided. They couldn't find a brain tumor. They couldn't find Parkinson's or ALS or, you know, anything after all the tests. And, you know, I guess maybe that was partying too much, you know, living such a destructive lifestyle.
Yeah.
But that led me then to this radical life change. And I guess act three of my life, which was going cold turkey and saying, I am going to quit smoking and I'm going to quit drugs and I'm going to quit gambling and I'm never going to look at a pornographic image for the rest of my life. I'm going to try to just shed all of these kind of dirty vices that I picked up and see if I can be of service, you know, see if I can be of service to God and refind a life of virtue and integrity and honor. And could I be in service to people who are suffering? And I kind of found the perfect opportunity, you know, where all these things collided in Liberia, West Africa, at 28 years old, aboard this hospital ship.
Yeah. Well, one more question about Act One. You say for years I've been pursuing the wrong things, from the BMW I bought as a teenager to the designer clothes I now wore to the drugs I took and hip cities I bragged about visiting. And this is something I always wonder about. Like, if I were talking to you and I was 20, I would be like, Scott, you're full of shit. All that sounds amazing. Like, I wonder if you have to go through this experience to come to this realization.
You might, but now at, you know, you're right in your 40s, you totally get that, because we have seen so many people, you know, sell their company or hit their number where the things that they always wanted to buy, now everything is instantly available. And we have seen the sadness that that brings. You know, the plane didn't bring joy. The island home didn't bring joy. The Lamborghini didn't bring joy, or the McLaren. You know, the five Hublot watches for 100 G's didn't bring joy. The relationship, you know, the girl that they never, girl or boy, or that they never could have had, didn't bring joy. So maybe in the 20s, but I also, I don't know, I've met some wise kids before who are futuristic and can look out and can just say, you know, I mean, the problem with materialism is that there really is never enough. I mean, someone always has more. And yeah, the more you want to accumulate, the more you want to accumulate. So I think it's really, you know, and conversely, the more you give, the more you want to give. You know, it's kind of these things become almost engines to themselves. And if you really get stuck in the accumulation game or the status game, I mean, it's pretty lonely.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, we had two people here. It kind of brought back memories of two conversations. Recently, I had Ken Honda, and he was telling me about the people that he's worked with, some of who are extremely wealthy. And he said, you know, one guy had a private jet, and he's like, do you feel rich? And he's like, no. He's like, why? He's like, because my friend who has a private jet had Versace basically do the interior of his plane, and I can't afford to do that. And then I think it was Kamal Rabikov who told me, who was like, yeah, he's like, in San Francisco, it's like you sell a startup for $100 million, you move into a new apartment, and you feel poor because the guy next to you has sold three startups for $100 million. Uh-huh. It's like, you're rich, but you feel poor.
Yep. There's always someone to chase.
Yeah.
Or if you're at the top of the game, you know, you're chasing the first trillionaire status, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've interviewed Justine Musk before, and what she said to me, you know, it was when she wrote that article about, you know, extreme success that ended up going viral. And I remember asking her, she said, you know, what people don't see are a couple of things. One is the amount of work that actually goes into this. And she said, and the other part is they don't see the fact that this literally comes at the cost of everything else in your life. It has to define your life if you want this. Like, she's like, it's an extreme way to live. And I mean, I think you can go look at Elon's personal life, and that's a pretty good example of the cost that you pay to have what he has.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that, the work that goes into it, because my favorite, and I'm being highly facetious here, question that I get, you know, sometimes at the end of a stage talk or, you know, an interview or something on TV, is someone will say, wow, Charity Water sounds really great. You know, is this your full-time job? And I'm like, is it my full-time job? We're raising $100 million a year, you know, running an organization, across 29 countries, you know, with thousands of local team members out there. It's like, no, it's a side gig. You know, if they only knew, I mean, we worked 100 hours a week. And, you know, that sounds like an exaggeration. And then you actually go and add up those hours and you get to 100 hours a week because you're just constantly working. You go home and you sleep for 6 or 7 hours and then you work. It's the only thing you do. You don't go to the movies. You're just constantly working in those early days to make sure that your startup, or your startup, you know, nonprofit doesn't die, because, you know, insolvency is kind of the existential threat for quite some time. Yeah. And the only way out of that is just to work.
Yeah.
You know, I was very fortunate. I mean, I know we're jumping forward in the timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
I was very fortunate to start Charity Water when I was 28 and didn't have any children. And, you know, I mean, what did I sacrifice? I sacrificed Netflix and chill. And I didn't sacrifice coaching my son's little league, which I get to do now, or, you know, taking my daughter to gymnastics. And I know so many entrepreneurs who started their journey, had kids, and just really didn't have a relationship with their kids. because it's really hard to do both in those early days.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then. Right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I just finished reading Lauren Graham's memoir. For people who don't know, she's on like Parenthood and a bunch of other TV shows like Gilmore Girls. And one of the questions she said that people often ask famous actors is like, when did you feel like you made it? And she said, never. Like, you know, literally, it's like, no matter how rich or famous you are, like, I realized, like, I finally came to the realization that this is a mirage that like I will never experience, you know, because I do this birthday post every year, and this year's like 46 reflections on a life half over. And I'm like, oh my God, it doesn't matter. Like, I've written 2 books with a publisher, raised funding, and I'm like, it's never going to happen. I'm chasing something that doesn't
exist. Well, try to take on a mission of trying to give the entire world clean water and see how that feels when there's 700 million people that you've yet to help.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, I think that You know, here's the thing, like a lot of our listeners being in the United States, I don't think many of them have seen the reality of like what poverty in a third world country looks like. I mean, having been born in India and having visited while growing up, like I got a firsthand glimpse of this, but probably nowhere as near as intense as the one you've got. And I think that first, give us a reality of this because, you know, I know you worked on the mercy ships. Like, what it, because I don't think we really understand the degree to which these people suffer because all we see are the stories and the pictures on TV. Like most people have never seen it up front.
I mean, I can talk about, you know, our issue. So 700 million people around the world are drinking disgusting, dirty, contaminated, diseased water right now. About 1 in 10 people alive on the planet. Twice the population of the United States of America. So huge, huge amount of people. And, you know, I'm betting, let's round up to 100% of the people listening to this did not wake up this morning and, you know, really think about water. I mean, we just take it for granted. We were born into a system, a country, an environment where clean water comes out of taps and it comes out of multiple taps. So, you know, I had a guy who works with me, you know, was an African. He came back from Africa and he lives in a very modest 3-bedroom home with his family. And he said, you know, I'm going to count how many taps I have in my 3-bedroom home. And he counted 17 places where clean water came out of taps in his home. You know, and you think about it, there's the refrigerator, there's the washer, there's the toilets and the showers and the sinks, and there's the hoses, the garden hoses. And, right. So that's kind of our reality. And then 10% of the world has never experienced one tap, you know, one cup of clean and safe drinking water because of what they were born into. So, you know, with that problem comes massive health implications in some of these developing nations throughout Africa, India, Southeast Asia, Central and South America. Up to 50% of the disease in these countries can just be tracked back to unsafe water and a lack of sanitation. So, you know, there's just obvious health problems if you're, you know, if you were to go out and drink from the brown swamp or your neighbor's pond, you're going to get sick. And if your child under the age of 5, they're going to potentially die of dysentery, of cholera, of they potentially go blind of trachoma. So health problems, mass education ramifications. So when I started Charity Water, a third of the world's schools didn't have clean water for their students. I mean, imagine that. 1 in 3 schools on planet Earth didn't have clean water or toilets or sanitation facilities. So it turns out, maybe no surprise, this is one of the top reasons why teenage girls will drop out around the world as their school has no water and no toilets. So there's education implications. There's, you know, really deep implications on women and girls, because it's always culturally the role of the women and girls to go get the water. And sometimes that water is 7 hours away round trip. And it's a 7-day-a-week affair. So very common for a woman in rural India or Africa to walk 49 hours every single week for dirty water, for water that's not even clean or useful to her family. And, you know, the men at best are working in the fields or working with livestock or maybe working at a factory trying to provide income. But so, you know, if you don't have water, your life is so radically different and so radically compromised. And what's kind of infuriating, but I guess also animating, is that it's a completely solvable problem. So there's not a single human being alive today who we don't definitively know how to help. We don't know what to do with pancreatic cancer, stage 4 pancreatic cancer. We don't know what to do with Parkinson's or ALS. We're spending billions of dollars trying to look for cures of incurable diseases. Water has a cure, and a lot of different technologies work in a lot of different environments, but you can always get clean water to a human if you want to. And the problem is nobody's wanted to. We are content because this problem doesn't affect us to not solve this problem. I mean, I joke, you know, I think it's slightly ironic. I mean, Elon Musk, richest guy in the world, you know, is looking for water on a planet 142 million miles away, right? Realizing water is going to be vital to civilization. And, you know, as we look down upon Earth, 10% of this planet is drinking disgusting water. So, you know, I think that's really the mission that I've been on for the last 17 years with Charity Water, is trying to create a movement, a global will to unlock the resources to direct at this problem so that we can create a day on Earth when everybody has clean water to drink. And therefore bring health to children and to families, therefore to bring better education and allow girls to go to school because their school now has water and they don't have to walk, to free up 49 hours, you know, for some women where they can use that extra time to lead their families, to lead their communities, to start small businesses and become entrepreneurs as they can earn income for their families. And yet we've done so little. You know, we've raised almost $1 billion, just shy of $1 billion now to help close to 20 million people. Well, that's 20 million people out of 703 million people who are still waiting. You know, it's 1/38 or so of the problem.
It's funny because I don't think people really viscerally experience this. Like you said, day to day, we just turn on a faucet and take it for granted. Like, I can tell you this, growing up in India, like when we would go to visit India as kids, we had to boil our water because it was, you know, you couldn't drink the water that came from the tap. You go to a restaurant, you had to make sure that there's no damn ice in the water and no hot showers. Like, can you imagine a teenager coming from America constantly bitching about all of this, not yep. realizing how, you know, like these are jokingly first world problems. You're right. We completely.
But the crazy thing is, you would actually not, what you just described to me, you would be yeah. counted as someone with clean water.
Yeah.
So you're not in that 703 million, you know, living in a rural area. And you know, so certainly you're in a water stressed area, but it gets even worse than that.
Yeah. So I can imagine. I think to your point, like, there are two things I wonder about. When you see something like that happen in a place like Flint, Michigan, here in the United States, that mm-hmm. must be infuriating to see that we would let that happen here. So one, what do you make of that? And two, like, getting people to actually give a shit. You know, yeah, I think challenge, right?
What was needed in Flint was, over $1 billion of infrastructure repair. So I think that was really unfortunate how slow the response was. But I mean, it was pretty simple. They needed to dig up $1 billion of pipe and fix it and put proper non-lead pipe in and redo all the infrastructure. So I think what was most, you know, and eventually, you know, I think the money came from FEMA, or, you know, the money was actually, it was a government problem, not an individual donor problem that just took far too long for the government to solve. Yeah. And in many of these countries, I mean, that's an objection I get every once in a while. Well, what is the government of Rwanda doing about water? You know, how come you're asking me to go help poor people in Rwanda get clean water to drink? I mean, I think what a lot of people don't understand is just how small many of these GDPs and total economies are, and how little money they have to meet all of the needs across a country where, you know, 95% of the people are subsistence farmers. So there's no tax revenue, you know, for people who are growing food on their small plots of land. I remember, just to pick on Rwanda, which I think is one of the most progressive, in a good way, African governments, you know, the entire budget for the country of Rwanda is less than New York City's public school district budget. Like one city wow. in America to run the schools. So you know, and Rwanda's got to take that, and they've got to do water and health clinics and roads and education and, you know, keep a government running. So I think that's why, you know, we really do believe philanthropic capital is needed to accelerate the progress that is happening, that is happening, but just happening at such a slow pace.
You know, there's something else you say in the book that really struck me. You say, on the ship, I used to hear the term culture shock all the time. Volunteers would spend 8 months in a country like Liberia and then come home and start judging everyone around them. How could you spend so much on a pair of shoes, a dinner, yeah, a watch, or a car? We talk about reentry like we're returning through the Earth's atmosphere from Mars. Talk to me about that, because I think that that is, honestly, that again is, in my mind, one of those things you'll never really understand until you experience it yourself.
You know, that feels a little, you know, I think I was early on in the journey there. I don't know that that culture shock served me well back then. Okay. I think I'm a lot less culture shocked the more I travel. I mean, I've been to Africa over 50 times now, and I've been to 72 countries. And, you know, this work takes me all over the world. So I wouldn't say that I'm jaded, but, you know, this is just the reality. I mean, rich people live in $50 million homes. And I'll watch a child drinking from a muddy river, vomiting every time she takes a drink. And this is just the disparity of the world that we live in. And I think in the early days, you know, I would have much more of a tendency to go judge the donor living in a $50 million house. Now it's really, it's my job to winsomely invite them to use their time and their talent and their money to meet some of these needs and really try to infect them with enthusiasm of what is possible. Alongside their beautiful $50 million home, they could also invest $50 million and bring 1 million people access to clean water. So it's not my job to make them feel guilty for what they have. It's my job to inspire them of what's possible with money in terms of human lives.
Well, I know, you know, from having read the book, this hasn't all been smooth sailing either. And I think that the quote that really kind of sums this up is, you say, we don't always get breaks, and believe me, not all my prayers have been met with miraculous solutions, yet over time I've come to embrace the mystery of faith. I think it's my job to work as hard as I possibly can, but also pray, and when breakthroughs do come, I try to hold on to them as proof of something much bigger that might just be at work. And, you know, I think that no matter what it is that we're doing, whether it's me hosting this podcast, like people trying to get careers off the ground, like we all have these like moments where we begin to question that faith. And I wonder how you maintain that when you're in the moment when, you know, it feels like everything could be over at any moment.
Again, this is a while ago. So you're taking me back to, you know, to early days of existential bankruptcy and insolvency, because we were a fundraising organization, and we also have a very unique model where we raise all of the overhead for Charity Water separately from about 130 entrepreneurs and families, so that 100% of all public donations from, you know, 150 countries around the world go directly to help people get water. So we even had kind of more existential challenges because we would raise millions and millions of dollars for clean water projects that we could never use to actually pay staff salaries or you know, the bill for the office unless we raise that money separately. But I think, you know, the element of faith, you know, a friend of mine, I really tend, so I'm a very kind of devout person. I do go to church. I'm active in our church and our local community, but I also try not to over spiritualize things. It's not that I don't want to give God credit. I just, I love the mystery of faith. And I think it's our job to work hard and certainly to pray and to invite God into that space. But, you know, also to work really hard and to use, you know, what I've been given to move the mission forward. And there have been all these moments where, you know, I was working really hard. And then something just so exponentially extraordinary, you know, something that was undeserved, you know, a monster donation would come in from the most unlikely source that I think was just encouraging. You know, I'm supposed to be doing this. I'm on the right. Keep moving forward, you know, one step after the next. I mean, I remember, I probably make, depending on the year, somewhere between 50 and 100 speeches a year on stages and just out there telling the story. And I could be talking to first graders sitting on the floor at a public school or 10,000 people in a stadium, you know, at a tech conference. But I really just have always believed, you know, every time I'm out there telling the story, I'm just sowing seeds and you never know who's listening and you never know whether that seed is going to fall on good ground or, you know, a bunch of people just say, ah, oh, that's not for me or who cares about water or, you know, how long it might actually take for that seed to, you know, to turn into something. And, you know, I have so many stories of just unlikely seed growth, I guess you could say. I mean, there was a event I spoke at once, the Inc. Magazine 5000 conference, and it was in Phoenix. And, you know, I spoke and there was somebody there, I think, that responded, you know, through the office and gave $30,000, which was enough to sponsor three water projects for three communities. And I never met the person and didn't even hear about the gift. And 7 years later, somebody on my team at the end of 2020 was reaching out and I think asked this person whether they would consider sponsoring one project. I mean, hey, it was 2020, right? Would they give $10,000? And this individual came back and said, I can give $10,000, but I can also give $10 million. Would you like $10 million? Bless her. She said, well, we actually have a $10 million program at Charity Water. And here's the details in the program and, you know, the impact there. And he made a $10 million gift. And he said, you know, the origin for me was sitting in the audience and hearing that story. And I told my wife, hey, if we ever have money, we're going to give it to this mission. And this is an entrepreneur. And in 2020, he had sold his company for $100 million and gave $10 million to, you know, to the work of Charity Water. So I have so many of those stories. Now, I didn't do anything different in that versus the 99 other speeches that year. But I did show up and I did get on the plane and I, you know, just on Sunday, I spoke three times, you know, almost an hour each time. And, you know, you're exhausted at the end of this, but you just never know who's listening and you just never know the benefit of time, you know, and kind of, I think it might've been Nietzsche actually that said like a long obedience in the same direction. So that's what I try to focus on, what I can control, which is starting year 18 and saying, I've got another year to give this mission and let me work as hard and as smart as I can to try to actually move us closer to a day when every human has clean water to drink.
So when you guys finish one of these projects, what is the impact on the community? What happens to them?
I mean, immediate health benefits in some communities, an 80% reduction in disease over the next 12 months, if it's at a school or if there's a school nearby, immediate education benefits girls primarily. I was in Uganda last year and I was at a school that had a Charity Water well at it. And I think they said 155 or 165 girls came back to that school because there was water and toilets at the school and clean water in the home. So they didn't have to walk and they could go to school. So, you know, many of those benefits, you know, women freed up time to start small businesses. You know, this woman, Postina, who we love in northern Uganda, bakes these delicious donuts because she has time back and she has clean water and she uses the money from selling her donuts to pay for school uniforms to put her kids through school. So, and then I think just the human dignity benefit, and we didn't even talk about that, but it's really undignified to drink brown viscous water, to pull out leeches or bugs or cow feces, you know, cause you're often sharing, these rural communities are often sharing the same sources with animals, with donkeys, with cows, with goats. And it's really dignified to drink clean and safe water. So I think that the human flourish, I mean, humans cannot flourish without clean water. You simply cannot live a good life, a healthy life, a dignified life, if you do not have the most basic need for human life met, and it's clean water.
So I have just a few more final questions for you. I know you mentioned that you have two kids, and I read about them in the book. I wonder, how has this influenced you as a parent and the values that you're passing on to your kids?
Well, I want my kids to be generous, and I want my kids to care for others. The values that I probably care most about have very little to do with charity water outside of maybe the generosity and compassion value. I mean, it's really about integrity and honesty and kindness. I care about the kinds of people that they become, much less about what they do for a profession or what they do with their lives. Now, both of my kids are young enough. I mean, they said, oh, it'd be fun to work with dad at some point. Great. That'd be fun. I've been able to take them to the field to see it before, but really care about their character far more than anything else. Maybe as I was a person who demonstrated very bad character for 10 years. So yeah. I would hope that they would not choose that path.
Well, I have two last questions for you. So you've kind of seen a combination of like levels of wealth. On the one hand, you start your life as a club promoter, getting to party with models, making all this money. Then you've seen this sort of extreme poverty, and you've also been exposed to these donors who have $10 million to spend to give to a charity like Charity Water. So I wonder, with perspective and time and age, how your own views on money and wealth have evolved.
I think the concept of enough, of kind of, contentment and knowing what is enough and not trying to reach for better cars and better houses and just a sense of gratitude. We're very fortunate, and I drive a Kia Telluride, and I love my Kia Telluride, but I don't envy the Porsche Cayenne or my friends with $100,000, Range Rovers. I have a great car. I have three kids, and it gets everybody around. And, I'm deeply grateful. We have a used Dodge Ram truck that's banged up because I dented it in New York City. And, I'm very content that I can go to Home Depot for my wife's DIY projects and throw a bunch of lumber in the back of a truck. But I don't need a Rivian, and if I had the extra money, I don't think I would buy a Rivian. And I think, I try to think about that in that principle of just being content with what we have and maybe a little more utility over status. I don't wear a watch, but if I did, it would be a Casio because it would help me keep time. It wouldn't be a Rolex or a Breitling. And nothing wrong with people who have really nice watches, but that I think has just helped keep me focused on the mission. And, you do make a sacrifice when you sign up for nonprofit vocation. I mean, I remember turning down a job at, one of the biggest tech companies, and it was pre-IPO. It was a C-level job, would have made me hundreds of millions of dollars had I taken it. And I've never regretted not taking any of those, huge opportunities where I could, 100x my income potentially, because, I'm on this mission and the mission is unfinished.
Wow. Well, this has been incredible, as I kind of imagined it would be. So I have one last question, which is how we finish all of our interviews. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
That's a great question. You see, you can tell I didn't know you were going to ask that. We talked about this earlier, right? Never sending interview questions. I think it's about the totality of the little things. I immediately go to character. The people that I respect the most, they're not the richest. They're not the most successful. They're not running the biggest companies or brands. You know, they have deep, deep character and integrity. They are intentional fathers or intentional mothers. They are givers. They are, so I think it's really about virtue and character and all of the little things. I mean, they do the right thing when nobody is looking. And I think that adds up to an unmistakable life.
Beautiful. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and your insights with our listeners. I think it's pretty obvious where people can find out about you, but in case they want to know more, where can they find out about your work, your books, and everything else?
Sure. Yeah. I wrote a book called Thirst. All the money goes straight to charity water, so I can never make a penny off it, but it became a New York Times bestseller. And if people are interested in more of the story, and there's a lot besides water and some of the Liberia stuff was super interesting. So that's, you can get that on Amazon. And then we're just at charitywater.org. I will say we have a community I'm really passionate about called The Spring, which is kind of like Netflix or Spotify, except we don't give you any music or movies. We just take your money every month and we use 100% of it to give people clean water. And that's been a real growth engine. A lot of people just give $40 a month. And that means one person every single month gets clean water around the world. And we've got some really cool tech where we report back on donations and stories of impact and all that. So that community, The Spring at Charity Water, has now expanded to 149 countries. You know, we have people giving in North Korea, and we have, 95-year-olds on their pension giving $10 a month. And I'm really passionate about kind of the grassroots community. And that's how I think these big problems eventually get solved, that enough people raise their hand and say, not on my watch. I'm going to resist the apathy that is so easy to accept with any of these paralyzing global issues and say, I could do something. I could build a well for 10 grand or I could, give $10 a month. And every 4 months, I know I've made a difference for one person. So all that's at charitywater.org. And I'm a bad follow on social media. I post very infrequently, and typically it's pictures of my kids.
And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.